Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Jeff.
Greetings from the world outside of the WBC. How do you feel the day after? We're recording this on Wednesday. The WBC is over. Will baseball survive without the WBC?
I'm still pulling the tinsel out of my hair. So much excitement. So much delight.
Was the Trout-Ohtani moment the greatest moment in the history of baseball, as we are led to believe?
Move over Bobby Thompson. Move over Hank Aaron. There's a new sheriff in town.
Because it seems to me that you don't need the season. All of the national baseball writers fell all over themselves to talk about how great the WBC was. And I'm not saying it wasn't great, but it's supposed to be a precursor for the season. And you had Tom Verducci, who I'll ask you about later, and Bob Nightingale of USA Today, which apparently still exists, and Michael Bauman of Fangraphs, and Ken Rosenthal of Fox. They were all falling all over themselves to tell us how great the WBC was. And it feels like Edwin Diaz was just a casualty. We took one for the greater good of baseball. It angers me because we're dismissing it. At least they are. I'm not, but they are. They're just saying, well, injuries happen. It was a fluke injury. It wasn't a fluke injury. He got hurt on a baseball field celebrating something that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for the WBC. Yeah, I'm still mad about it.
We will not be shifting to an all WBC format, I suppose, from here on out. The people who cover it, they enjoyed it. That is their right. And I'm glad they enjoyed it. And that is bound to come out in their coverage. I could do without the, and you're all idiots if you didn't enjoy it, angle of it. You mentioned Tom Verducci. Tom Verducci wrote a column about 10 minutes after Edwin Diaz was carried off the field and not hoisted on his teammates' shoulders, unfortunately, but carried off the field with the torn patellar tendon that appears to have completely canceled his major league season. Tom Verducci's attitude was basically, what kind of moron are you if you think the WBC isn't the greatest thing since sliced pepperoni? And I came away thinking, like, if Tom Verducci, who's been around a long time, he's a terrific writer, prolific writer, a fast writer, and mostly nothing but admiration for him as a professional. But I couldn't help but think that if he were on assignment in Dallas on November 22nd, 1963, his first reaction would be to tell everybody who was in horror and shock at what they had seen, how can you be against the beauty and majesty of open-air presidential motorcades? They're still great. Not that this was the same, but hey, we're Mets fans. This is how we think. The WBC is now over. It was, by many accounts, a success around the world. People who wouldn't have been watching baseball were glued to this thing. In the United States, people who could take or leave another exhibition game from Florida or Arizona may have been glued to this, or at least looked in. It gave us something to talk about. And you can't discount the fact that the players who participated unanimously, or so it seems, universally might be the better word, were thrilled to be there. And we're talking about major leaguers. We're talking about American major leaguers for whom playing baseball games at this level is what they do. I'm not discounting people, players from Japan and Mexico and everywhere else, but you might figure that people who grew up without this sort of international competition might be jaded or blasé, and they certainly weren't. So I think this is, to use, which cliche do you want? The genie back in the bottle or the toothpaste back in the tube? Because neither one of them is happening. The WBC is here to stay. We can curse its existence when something like what happened to Diaz happened, or if we were Astros fans, something like what happened to Altuve breaking his thumb in a game that would not have been taking place without a WBC being pitched the way it was, if only because it was the WBC. Like I said, we can curse its existence, but we can't curse it out of existence. The only thing I'm trying to think of a good allegory in baseball history here. There really isn't one. best I could come up with. 1973, a year close to our hearts, divisional play was 5 years old at that point, which meant the league championship series was 5 years old at that point. And for the first time, the two best records in each league, which had belonged to Cincinnati and Baltimore, were not going to meet in the World Series. Up to that point, you had at least one of the best records in a league, that team going to the World Series from 69 to 72. 73, Oakland did not have as good a record as Baltimore. And we know the Mets did not have as good a record as Cincinnati or several teams in the National League West. And I can picture us maybe being a little sore about it if we weren't Mets fans, if we were Reds fans or Orioles fans that year, saying, this isn't a real World Series. What is this nonsense with a playoff? But by then, the playoffs were here to stay. And that might be a bit of a tortured analogy, but I think the WBC is here to stay. I have two things that are on my mind about it after all is said and done in 2023. One is one that's been brought up a lot. Like, does it have to be in March when you have players who aren't necessarily ready or aren't necessarily ready to go all out? And I couldn't help but notice the kind of pitchers the USA was sending out there were not sending our best. Let's put it that way. And it's kind of hard to take it seriously if you don't have Max Scherzer, which is the last thing I know that you want to see, and maybe I want to see. But if you're not sending Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander to represent the USA or Clayton Kershaw or anybody of that ilk. But the other thing I was thinking about, and I think the reason guys like us, fans like us, have a hard time sort of validating it, is it just feels so disconnected from what goes on in the course of a year. We have what I like to call a ballological clock. You know, we have the offseason, we have the hot stove league, the trade deadlines and the free agency, and then the pitchers and catchers and the reporting and the stretching, and then the intra-squad games and the B-squad games, and then the exhibition games and so on and so forth. And then the regular season, everything that happens there, and then the postseason. Where does this WBC come from if you're not ready for it? I don't think either one of us and a lot of people are just like not ready for it. I'm shocked when I learned that Japan had been keying on this for years. And, you know, good for them. Good for any federation that does this. And I'm sure there are people in the United States whose job it was to be thinking about the WBC well in advance. Just as a fan, it just kind of comes to me, kind of comes out of nowhere. Now, maybe that changes with this, if this was the watershed moment that it's being made out to be, because of all the talented position players who played for the U.S. and for the passion that was there. It's nice to see countries representing, but not in enmity, not certainly not with guns, not with harsh words, but the best baseball players in the world respecting each other and going after each other on the field. That's like the Olympic ideal without the nonsense of the Olympics. But unfortunately, there is a downside, and the downside will come in the ninth inning when there's a one-run lead and there are no trumpets blowing and there is no Edwin Diaz. And maybe whoever's pitching instead of Edwin Diaz is going to do a heck of a job, but ain't going to be Edwin Diaz. And we are just never going to get that out of our mind that this happened and it doesn't feel like it ever should have. And that's with the acknowledgement that injuries do happen in spring training and injuries happen all year round in ways that you don't think are going to happen. And that, if you'll forgive me for saying this, the greatest relief pitcher of all time, Mariano Rivera, missed a year from shagging a fly ball. Something snapped. These things happen, but this man, this was just so strange to watch. I was watching that game and I was rooting for Puerto Rico because Edwin Diaz was pitching and because Francisco Lindor was playing shortstop. I mean, I may not be the ideal WBC fan because I root for the Mets who are in the WBC. And secondarily, if there's a good storyline or USA, I'm from there. I like them. But to watch Edwin Diaz suddenly disappear into his teammates' joyous embrace and not get up, that's just so much to overcome. But I tell you, if something like that can stop the WBC Express or at least turn it into a local, I'm not sure what will. So, you know, we're going to get on with our season and we're going to think less and less about this. I think if the Edwin Diaz factor wasn't a part of it, we wouldn't be thinking about it at all. The last game was Tuesday. We're talking on a Wednesday. By Friday, I think if there wasn't for Edwin Diaz, I will have completely forgotten that WBC took place, which is not to say it wasn't an amazing thing. It's just, again, outside the realm of what we, not everybody, but we as fans look forward to and think about. Reading an article today, the day after the WBC, by Ben Lindbergh, terrific writer, definitely a pro-WBC viewpoint. And he said, got to play it every year, got to play it every other year. At the very least, you don't want to lose this momentum and you don't want to have a march without this sort of thing. And you know what? Despite any misgivings I might have about anything that would put a Met in danger like Edwin Diaz, I don't think he's off track, because for this thing to not feel alien, to not feel like it was just dropped from the sky, and you know, good luck if you don't like it, and good luck if your closer gets hurt, maybe it just needs to be a part of what baseball is on an annual or biennial basis. And maybe you get some of those starting pitchers who are not there involved, because now it's part of what they do. And again, maybe you do it in November, maybe you change the All-Star break. I think I would just like to feel that it is not just kind of being inflicted upon us. It's a great tournament, or at least it's a great idea, and it's a good tournament. I think just going forward, as they say, find a way to incorporate it into baseball in a way where you don't find yourself snarling when something like this happens, then feel yourself sort of isolated when you're mad about it, because how could you not be upset that you lost Edwin Diaz?
Well, I get it, the national fervor. What I read today, that 101% of Japanese televisions were on watching the game. Wait, let me check that. 92% was the number watching in Japan. I watched 3-4 innings. It didn't stop me from watching the latest episode of Ted Lasso first. It wasn't a Mets game, so I put it on when Ted Lasso was over. And I understand that it's exciting, and I understand the national fervor that exists, but I'm not going to be like the MLB reporters who bow down before Manfred and dismiss our concerns. Again, they make it seem as if Diaz was a necessary casualty for the greater good. What have I said on this show before? Baseball is not my favorite sport. Mets baseball is my favorite sport. So before the WBC, I expressed concern. When I did the solo show reluctantly a few weeks ago, I said, I want the Mets players to do well in the WBC. I want the teams they're on to do well. But between you and me, if they're eliminated early and the Mets players go back to Port St. Lucie quickly, I won't be upset. That didn't happen. And the irony is that Diaz got hurt in the game when Lindor circled the bases, and all of us at the same time yelled out, don't pull something. Here are fluke injuries in Mets history. What happened to Diaz was not a fluke injury. Again, it happened on a baseball field. Getting hurt while moving a sofa is a fluke injury. A Met player once got hurt getting in a taxi cab in Miami before a series. That's a fluke injury. A Mets player, he sheared off part of his finger in a gardening accident. That's a fluke injury. A Mets player fell off his horse on his ranch when the horse was startled by a wild boar. Getting hurt in a dog pile while on a baseball field when you're a baseball player is not a fluke injury. Those were fluke injuries, right, Greg?
Yeah, things happen in life. You wake up on the wrong side of the bed, as they say. I'm going to do one thing here that I think in the interest of fairness needs to be said, or at least amplified, as you said, that the players, you said before, the players love it. I'm going to believe that there is benefit to the players having been there. I'm going to believe that for somebody like Jeff McNeil, who talked about getting to spend time with great players, getting to spend time with Ken Griffey Jr., getting instruction from Ken Griffey Jr., no offense to Eric Chavez and the Mets batting coaches over the years. And then Francisco Lindor would know. He said, you know, like the World Series, words to that effect. I don't worry that they're not in camp. These are veterans. And I don't think 2 weeks where they're with Nolan Arenado and Paul Goldschmidt and Mike Trout, Mookie Betts as their teammates, and having that sort of luster rub off on them might be too strong a word. But being at that higher level, as opposed to, well, you know, I'm not making the trip today to West Palm Beach. I'll get my running in or whatever it is. I don't worry about that. Ideally, every Met together 24/7, learning everything there is to learn, especially in a year with new rules. The Mets weren't the only team involved. And again, this is not about Edwin Diaz's injury, which is its own baseball tragedy, if that's not too strong a word. A baseball tragedy, not a real life tragedy. Edwin is home. Edwin's contract is covered. Edwin has Steve Cohn sending him a dietitian and a trainer and Uber Eats, probably. He's going to be fine. I don't worry about him. And it's nice to see him, you know, sending the thumbs up via social media. So I think there are, you know, just from a Mets standpoint, I think it's an experience for these players. And you never know how that sort of thing will play out. It's as possible as anything that Pete Alonso does something at bat later this year. And he says, that's something I picked up from talking to Paul Goldschmidt, who was his idol. As it is, say, oh, I didn't know the signs because I wasn't in camp for 2 weeks back in March. And I should have bunted there. And I bunted and I shouldn't have bunted, said Jeff McNeil. I'm not too worried about that. And I realize it exists because there's money in it and it's business. But I would not, at this point, look to deprive the players who want to be a part of this from being a part of it. Again, I think that here's another one. Horses left the barn with the toothpaste out of the tube and the drinking out of the bottle, where that's concerned. Although, from one more WBC thought, which I thought it was telling when Billy Epler, in describing what was going on with Diaz, was asked, I forget the exact phrasing, but you know, were you able to keep any players from going? And he allowed that Starling Marte wanted to go, but they were able to kind of put the kibosh on it because he was coming off of surgery, and that is an allowance that teams have. So he said in so many words, like, we said no, and we were able to get that done. And he had this look about him that said, oh, maybe I shouldn't have put it that way, or maybe I shouldn't have said it. And yeah, I suppose in his heart of hearts, Buck Showalter, for, you know, not even heart of hearts, he's said in so many words that, you know, he preferred that everybody kind of be on the same page. But again, it exists. And I think it is incumbent upon Major League Baseball and whatever other governing bodies throughout the world are involved in making this jibe as well as it can with regular seasons everywhere, but especially because this is where we are in Major League Baseball. Doesn't feel like it's quite there yet. I hope that as soon as Edwin Diaz is up for it and he wants to go get a nice snack, that he doesn't call the same cab Duaner Sanchez did and that he doesn't get that yen to fix his shrubbery like Bobby Ojeda did at the wrong time. As far as horseback riding and Yoenis Cespedes, I don't know if they crossed paths at the WBC. Probably didn't. Different pools. But stay away from that maybe until you're retired.
Or moving a sofa like Lucas Duda.
Yeah.
But you make a good point there about some mental benefits from being there, because it wasn't shown on the field. Other than Lindor, none of the Mets, except you could argue McNeil's great at bat last night in the ninth inning, did anything. Alonso didn't even play. He had 14 at bats. He didn't hit any home runs. McNeil had 13 at bats, went 1-for-9 with 4 walks. Ottavino only had 2 innings pitched. Lindor had 20 at bats, so he had a productive series. But Escobar only had 10 at bats. Omar Narváez left the Mets, a team he was just traded to. He did not learn his new pitching staff for 2.5 weeks for what? 4 at bats. So it's frustrating. Yes, I hope you're right, Greg. Maybe there's some mental absorption that will help these players.
On that, I mean, yeah, I'm sure we all like to play. If you were to put me on an imaginary writing staff with some of the greatest writers of all time, there with Roger Angel and George Vesey and Steve Rushen and you name them. And you just said, okay, Greg, you have to do the capsules of high school lacrosse because we've got the greatest writers around you. And you're not that high on the pecking order, but you can hang out with Roger Angel and George Vesey and Steve Rushen. I would take that opportunity, and I'd be talking about it for the rest of my life, probably. You know, and there are different ways to be a teammate and to be part of a team. And anybody who hasn't, what was it, like a couple of years ago, Kevin Pillar, for example, is considered this great teammate. He didn't play all that often, players looked up to him. Eduardo Escobar had that role in Venezuela. May end up having that role on the Mets as the season progresses. So I understand, like, if you're going to be gone, like, make sure you bring back a trophy, for crying out loud. And, you know, you better be on the all WBC team or whatever it is they have. I imagine that Pete Alonso, maybe this drives somebody like him or McNeil to say, you know what, I want to be first string in 2026. This is my, along with winning a World Series, this is my goal. It was exciting to watch Lindor. He was like super WBC player. It was exciting till that very last thing. It was exciting watching Diaz ply his craft. If you saw the, not that I wanted Team Israel to be no hit, but if you saw the no hitter, it's incredible. I even got a kick out of watching Javi Baez again. These guys are operating on a different wavelength. They're excited to play for their country, so they say. They're excited to play with one another. They're excited to compete against one another. Maybe if they're going to do this in March, they figure out a way to push back the season, maybe one more week in the future. But, you know, those are ideas for when we're thinking about WBC again, which, like I said, probably won't be after this week.
To be a contrarian, I wish more players thought the way Nimmo did. The Mets just gave me a contract for $1 bazillion. I'm not going to leave to go play for Team Italy. As Nimmo said, I'm going to here to work for my employer. I wish that all of the Mets said that. And as you paraphrase Billy, the Mets didn't have the power to stop them. In the future, there's talk about moving it to midseason, but that messes up the teams from around the world. Moving it to the end of the season, Fox doesn't want it. Fox barely showed this. They only had one game on the parent network. They had, Fox has enough broadcasting in November, and maybe the players are tired in November. So this may be it, perhaps, and I'm not saying this is a brilliant idea, but perhaps you start the spring training schedule earlier. You have a full spring training, so nobody's leaving after 2 weeks, and then playing in intense games without a proper spring training. And then you, at the time the season's supposed to start, that's when you have the WBC. And maybe you can even play 2 out of 3s instead of single elimination games in the quarterfinals, et cetera. And then you compress the season, send the season another week into November. Maybe that's the way to go. That's not a perfect plan, because that means players who have prepped for the season are sitting around for 2 weeks. But I think it's better than what we have.
In 1995, because of the strike ending when it did, they played a 144-game schedule. Again, we won 162 games. But that year, 144 games, once it was announced, it's like, okay, the season's going to be 144 games. That year, the last week of April is when the season started. If you wanted to say every 3 years, might be a little unwieldy for record keeping. And then you're bringing up, why is the regular season as long as it is anyway? Maybe you do something like that. You just say, you know what, it's, you know, hell, we just had a 60-game season a couple of years ago. Maybe we say every WBC year is a year where we only play 148 games. I'm just making that number up. It's something that needs to be addressed and needs, you know, I think, you know, we both said, for whatever solution we're trying to formulate, it's not perfect. It's not ideal. Nothing is, because we, you know, again, we decided long ago baseball was perfect the way it is, except you can always improve it. And this in some way was meant as an improvement. It's kind of an augmentation rather than an improvement. And it's, you know, we hope it's not a square peg in a round hole. And we hope most of all that our closer is back on 2 feet soon enough.
And as you said, in 2 days, you'll forget who won, but we will remember the Diaz injury all season long when Dave Robertson or Adam Ottavino or whomever comes through the bullpen gate and trumpets are not blaring. We'll see what the Mets do as a closer. Will it be Robertson? Will it be Ottavino? Will it be some combination? Is Brooks Raley healthy? Drew Smith is finally pitching up to what we hoped. He looks good. John Curtis and Tommy Hunter have had great springs. We haven't heard anything about Zach Britton since his audition. So we'll see what happens with the Mets bullpen. But it won't be the same.
Can't be the same. But if it's, I don't even want to say comparable, because, you know, we just lived through one of the great closing seasons we've ever seen from a Met. Although if you think about it, you know, what was it, like 60 some odd innings? Yeah, very, very important innings for the most part. I'm not looking to discount them or diminish them, but you can only use, at least in the contemporary game. You can only use your closer of that ilk when you have a lead or it's, you know, the eighth inning and it's tied, one of those situations you carve out for him. And I think we both sat by in September thinking, I hope Edwin Diaz isn't gathering cobwebs, because every game it felt like for about 3 weeks was the Mets ahead by six or behind by six. And the only time you saw him, it felt like for a few weeks was, well, Buck is getting him some work. And then Buck has to hesitate because what if he ends up throwing 30 pitches tonight in a relatively meaningless comparative to a one-run game situation, and I need him tomorrow night when it really is a one-run situation. So you know, that that's not a silver lining or anything. It's just, it's 60 innings out of, you can do the math, 162 times nine plus whatever extra innings there are. And as far as the replacements or the prospective fill-ins, I mean, these are major league pitchers. We're not auditioning off of the street. No offense to Zach Britton, who not exactly auditioning off the street either. His showcase, no, we haven't heard very much about that, I suppose. There's a reason Edwin Diaz was lavishly compensated, and it's tough to replace. And, you know, the frustrating part of that, putting aside the circumstances of how he got injured, was the journey he took from 2019 being this guy who you'd heard so much about and is giving up home runs every other inning or so, it seemed. And yeah, can we possibly trade Edwin Diaz to getting his act together slowly but surely, lowering our blood pressure 20 and then 21 and then, you know, this particular season? And really the only flip side I can come up with from that, and I think I said at the outset of spring training, was I almost had the sense of, well, he can't possibly be this good again. Well, we've taken care of that, I suppose. But if you are to look at it in the vein of, well, if he was going to have a down year by comparison to last year, well, we'll miss that now. Listen, the point here is, now there will be ninth innings, and knock wood, there will be many leads, and somebody's going to pitch. And the names you mentioned, I'm not averse to seeing them as best available options, pending whatever it is we see as the season gets going. There's a reason they went out and got experienced, reliable, as far as we can tell, because you never can tell, relief pitchers. That's why you go out and get, maybe that wasn't the plan, but if you're going to talk about depth, getting somebody like David Robertson to be around, a closer of his background to not be the closer, well, now he's the closer, possibly. Or Adam Ottavino, they didn't let him get away. The eighth inning is very important. Maybe the ninth inning will be his calling and he can do that. I was listening during the most recent SNY telecast as they were talking to John Franco, who was in Port St. Lucie as a special instructor. And he said, you know, and this man pitched more ninth innings, I assume, than any Met in history. And he said, you know, got to treat whatever inning you're in like it's the ninth inning, like it's the most important inning. And hopefully whatever it is, the experienced relief pitchers, and really at this point we're talking about experienced relief pitchers, they carry that into whatever their assignment is. And one of them is going to be the ninth inning that they weren't necessarily counting on, you know, a week or so ago. It ain't great, but it's not, I don't think it's a black hole. I don't think it's a void. I don't think we'll be going, oh my God, who's going to blow it now? And now that I've said that, I don't even want to believe I said that out loud. But I think we're going to be as okay as we can be. And that's all we can hope for.
Well, one ramification, though, is that everybody moves up one. So it's possible that we'll have a situation due to various events, rainouts, a lot of activity, a lot of games, that Steve Nogashek is pitching in the eighth inning because they have to save Robertson for the ninth inning. And you wouldn't have had that if Diaz wasn't hurt. So the ramifications will be felt all season. But moving on to this weekend's last few preseason games, we'll look to see if Brandon Nimmo gets into games Saturday and Sunday, as Buck said he would on Wednesday. He had that terrible slide and he's been out, but he had a good day on Wednesday. We'll welcome back Pete Alonso, who's going to schlep with the team to two road trips, one to the Braves complex and one to the Tampa Bay complex in Orlando. Jeff McNeil's going to stay behind and get 15 at-bats in a day with the minor leaguers because he hasn't had at bats. And then soon, Greg, one day you and I will not be sitting at the Cadillac Club at Payson's. We won't be sitting there at the Cadillac Club at Payson's because it's $24,999 a seat. Good job by Steve Cohen naming it. It's at Payson's. I don't know at Payson's what? Payson's building, Payson's club. No, it's the Cadillac Club at Payson's something. For 25 grand a seat, Steve Cohen said, as the original owner of the Mets and pioneer, Joan has played a significant role in our organization, an underrated figure in sports history. But didn't she sit with the fans?
There were no Cadillac clubs at the Polo Grounds. There were no Cadillac clubs at Shea Stadium. There were the Diamond Club. There was the Met Lounge. Not too many people know about that, the 2 years that the Mets were in the Polo Grounds. But those were more for hanging out before, afterwards. No, this is not, well, this is something they're inventing to sell memberships in, but the space itself, I'm sure, renovated and much ritzier, kind of word you don't get to use that often in this life. It's where the Mozone was and where the Honda Club was. And I had the opportunity to sit in that space once, and it was a treat. Somebody was nice enough to invite me. Kind of a interesting angle for the ball game, but there's a lot more to it than just here. You're right by the right fielder. There's amenities. Remember amenities? That's what was going to separate Citi Field from Shea Stadium. And you know, if that is why you were coming to Citi Field, you were probably gratified. But now, I think this is, and I don't know how common a space like this is around baseball. I know Oracle Park, and I have to think for a second of what it's called, the one in San Francisco, has a space called the Gotham Club, which is, I've never seen it, but it's close to my heart because it pays homage to the Giants' New York roots. So I like that as a theme. I don't know how Payson-ish Payson's is going to be from the CGI they released. There's, you know, some fine Met photographs and memorabilia on the wall. I didn't see any pictures of Joan Payson, but I'm sure they'll figure that out. You're absolutely right. Joan Payson should be an enormous figure in sports history, in the telling of sports history. How many women owned a baseball team in 1962? And how many owners, as you said, sat with the fans? Listen, it was a nice seat. It was the box seat next to the Mets dugout. She deserved that. She was a woman of the people. I have to say, I approve of a lot of what Steve Cohen has done. And I realize that quote was, I'm sure, crafted by somebody whose job it is to craft quotes. I'm familiar with that particular word craft, shall we say. And I guess he can do it because he is an owner of a Major League Baseball team. And Mrs. Payson was an owner of a Major League Baseball team. It's hard for me to think of anybody referring to her as Joan. She's Mrs. Payson. Just the way it hits the ear. Cadillac Club at Mrs. Payson's, or Mrs. Payson's Place, if you go back to the 60s, might be a little more appropriate. I'm not in this to glorify a car company. Listen, anything you can do to have her name in more places at Citi Field is a welcome addition. There is, I don't know if it continues to exist in light of this new development, but there is sort of a VVIP entrance, not like the ones they have with the big mosaics of Stengel and Seaver and Hodges. Like it's a door you would almost not notice on the first base side, and it says Payson on it. And that's where they send certain VIPs to go get their credentials or tickets or whatever allows them to be very important people for a night. And in a way, it's kind of clever. It's almost like going through, you know, the kitchen, the Copa in Goodfellas, because when they take you through there, it doesn't look like anything and suddenly you're on the field. But she deserves more than that. Huge part of the Mets story. When you get into 1962 and the beginnings, there are always four names that can't be repeated enough. Casey Stengel, George Weiss, Bill Shea, and Mrs. Payson. And, you know, we have Shea Bridge and we had Shea Stadium. We have a Stengel entrance. You know, we have a lot of Casey Stengel in our DNA. And, you know, George Weiss may not have been the warmest figure, so I'm not going to worry about him. But they're all in the Mets Hall of Fame, as is Mrs. Payson. But can't do enough to talk about Mrs. Payson. So yeah, the 25 large is going to be tough to come up with, but I look forward to seeing it on TV. I look forward to Steve Gelbs taking us on a tour. If they let Steve Gelbs in, I know that, you know, he does a lot for SNY, but I don't know if that they'll let him in there because it's a speakeasy. And I'm not sure why it's a speakeasy as opposed to just a club. I guess that makes it sound a little less obnoxious. But Mrs. Payson, thank you, wherever you are. Thank you for getting us a team. Thank you for getting us a National League franchise for our National League team.
And again, as we look to the weekend, Francisco Alvarez was sent down on Wednesday. I questioned on this show what the Mets would do if he hit 5 home runs. He didn't hit any. He went 3 for 28. He needs to work on his defense. He's still getting over his ankle injury. We'll see him again soon. Will Brett Beatty make the team? Will he start? Will he be the right-handed DH if Darren Ruff is IL'd or doesn't make the team? So a lot to look forward to as we get closer to opening day. Before we go, Jesus Alou passed away at the age of 80. He was a Met in 1975, and he was part of a great baseball family. And anyone that wore the Mets uniform is worth remembering.
You know, if you grew up in the 60s and the 70s and you were a baseball fan, you knew this much about the sport you chose. There were 3 strikes, there were 3 outs, and there were 3 Alous. The Mets were Alou adjacent for many years. Jesus Alou came up to the San Francisco Giants while they were playing the Mets in 1963. Who else was on the San Francisco Giants at the time? Felipe Alou, Matty Alou, and now Jesus Alou. What did their manager, Alvin Dark, do? He found a way to get them all to the plate in the same inning, one Alou after another. A reporter in San Francisco covering the game said, it's like a vaudeville act. And then when circumstances allowed, which is to say the Giants had to be far enough ahead where Alvin Dark felt comfortable telling Willie Mays to take a seat for a couple of innings, because yeah, never sat Willie Mays if you could help it. He managed to get all 3 Alous into the outfield. 3 separate games. The last of those was against the Mets. So the Mets were there at the beginning of the Alou legend. The idea of the Giants having 3 Alous didn't hold as a fact for very long, because going into 64, Felipe was traded to the then Milwaukee Braves. By 66, Matty, great singles hitter, would be traded to the Pirates. So Jesus Alou was the last Alou in San Francisco, establishing his major league bona fides. Remember reading when I was a kid, he's the baby of the family. I thought that was a very funny thing to call what looked to me a full-fledged adult that I was looking on my baseball card at. Like, he's a baby? He looks pretty big to me. But yeah, I got it. 3 brothers, Felipe the oldest, Matty the middle, and Jesus trying to keep the family name in lights, and he certainly did a good job. Jesus Alou was having a very representative career in the 60s, played for the Giants, played for the Astros, went over to the American League, played for the Oakland A's. We saw him again in the 1973 World Series. He had come along late in the year to Oakland. Oakland was very famous is the word, but Charlie Finley liked to pick up veterans who could help in the short term, and you wouldn't have to pay them for very long. So they had a bit of a revolving door there. Well, Jesus Alou came through that revolving door, stuck around for a while, played a big part on the A's, winning again in 73, winning their division, winning their playoff series with Baltimore, played in all 7 games of the World Series against the Mets. We don't have to hold that against him because he didn't have that great a World Series, to be honest with you, but he established himself in Oakland. Stuck around in 74 when they won again. So while he's not the first Oakland A you think of from that era, he's got 2 World Series rings. And then we get to spring training of 75, where Charlie Finley, you know, for those who know why I'm throwing this name around, for those of you who are not familiar, Charlie Finley was the mercurial. Nobody's ever called mercurial as a compliment. The mercurial owner of the Oakland A's, who kind of just did what he felt like doing and did it on a shoestring, and his players, for the most part, were not crazy about him, nor were his managers, nor were the fans. He was the proponent of, among many other things, the designated pinch runner, or at the very least, one guy on the roster whose job it was to pinch run. And famously, in 1974, that was Herb Washington. I say famously because nobody has an example like Herb Washington. He only pinch ran, never played the field, never batted. You know, not even along the lines of what we've seen from Terrence Gore, for example. Okay, we get to 75. Charlie Finley loves his designated runner idea so much, he's going to have two speedy guys on the bench. This squeezes out Jesus Alou, who was having a hell of a spring training in Arizona for Oakland. Meanwhile, across the country in St. Petersburg, the Mets had hoped that Cleon Jones would be fully recovered from the leg miseries that had been plaguing him. He wasn't. They get to opening day. They have to put Cleon on the disabled list. They do not have a full roster. And they say, well, who are we going to call up, or who are we going to put out there? Well, they had somebody scouting in Arizona. They said, you know what? Jesus Alou, this guy we've known for many years from the Giants and the Astros and the World Series in 73, he was tearing up the Cactus League. So after a full spring training of going through all the possibilities of who's going to be on the opening day roster, well, about 3 days after opening day, Jesus Alou is now on the Mets, which goes to show you, don't take everything you see in spring training as gospel, because somebody's going to show up and open your eyes. And that's exactly what Jesus Alou did. Jesus Alou, prototypical veteran by that point, bat off the bench, a terrific pinch hitter. Yes, only 1 year, but that 1 year, he was dynamite. He was a 350 pinch hitter. And because you had Ed Kranepel, who we remember as a dynamite pinch hitter in the second half of his career, was playing in the everyday lineup more often than not, Jesus Alou is the batter who's coming off the bench in those late innings for Yogi Berra and later Roy McMillan. And yeah, he lasts the year and he's still in the Mets' plans for 76, but you know how baseball can be. The Mets had another pinch hitter, a lefty pinch hitter, an outfielder named Bruce Beauclair, who was impressing people in St. Petersburg. And they had another outfielder who they wished was impressing people in St. Petersburg. Unfortunately, got hurt. Hey, you want to talk about fluke injuries? Mike Vail broke his foot playing basketball that winter. Not in the World Basketball Classic, but it was a pickup game. I don't know why he was playing basketball, but it put him out. And remember, the Mets had traded Rusty Staub to make room for Mike Vail, who had had the 23-game hitting streak. Why am I bringing all of this up? Because Beauclair had options, and Vail had options. You hear about options with relief pitchers. We'll hear about it a lot probably this year. Jesus Alou didn't have options. Jesus Alou, despite still being able to swing the bat, was squeezed off the roster. He'd had visa problems. Remember, you used to hear about that a lot more, players from other places, in his case, the Dominican Republic. It just didn't work for Jesus Alou and the Mets in 1976. And they let him go at the time. Joe Frazier, the new manager of the Mets, said, hey, Jesus is a nice guy. I wish we could have kept him. And that may sound like boilerplate, and it probably was. But you know what? Everybody said Jesus Alou was a sweetheart and a thoughtful human being. And, you know, a quote that went around after he died, this was from Jim Boughton in the book that he wrote after Ball for, I hope you didn't take it personally, he said, Jesus Alou, or Jay, as they called him, was the kind of guy who would, like, walk a mile to find a beggar so he could give him money. You can't ask for much more out of a human being than to attract endorsements like that. So Jesus Alou's career was almost over at that point. He actually was out of baseball for a couple of years, but he still had some baseball left in him, went back to Houston, played parts of two seasons for them, the end of the 70s, and continued in baseball, worked as a scout, Marlins scouting director early in the 2000s before they won the World Series, helped scout the Dominican Republic for the Boston Red Sox as the Red Sox were winning one World Series after another, breaking their curse. I thought it was telling that when Jesus passed away, not only the Giants, not only the A's, but the Red Sox posted their condolences. This is a man who touched a lot of people in baseball, obviously touched the next generation and his family. And as we know, talk about being Alou adjacent, nephews of Jesus Alou, Moises Alou, a Met for 2 years, 2007-2008, one of the premier hitters of his time. Mel Rojas, relief pitcher, not a great relief pitcher for the Mets, but a good relief pitcher in his day with the Expos, especially before he came to the Mets. And yes, the manager of the New York Mets before Buck Showalter, Luis Rojas, all part of that Alou family. You can't not say baseball doesn't run in the blood in that family. And we were lucky enough to benefit certainly in 75. And I'll just throw one more thing in personally about Jesus Alou and seeing his baseball card when I was a little kid. That is the first time I ever saw that first name in any context. Imagine my surprise when I found out there's a Jesus somebody and he's not in baseball because, oh, that's like Jesus Alou. So, you know, not to put Jesus Alou on too high a pedestal, but from all we've read and all we might remember, good player, good person. Thank you for 1975. And then here's to a life well-lived.
Thank you, Greg. Our condolences to Jesus Alou's family. May he rest in peace. We received a letter from Kevin Connell about our show on baseball movies, and he pointed out a 1928 Buster Keaton silent film called The Cameraman. And he took us to a clip that you can find on YouTube where Buster Keaton goes to Yankee Stadium to take pictures of the Yankees, except the Yankees are in St. Louis. So Buster Keaton does what any of us would do if we were on a baseball field. He makes believe he's playing baseball. And there's one part of that. It's only a 3-minute excerpt from the movie. It's not a baseball movie, but has this baseball scene where Buster Keaton runs the bases. Now, I don't know if the film was sped up. I don't know about the timing of the movie. This was 100 years ago, but he flies around the bases. It's a great scene. Clear images of Yankee Stadium from 1928. We thank Kevin Connell for bringing it to our attention, and you can find it on YouTube.
Can I just say, on the subject of movies, I learned something this week reading a terrific book called The Pitch That Killed about the, you may have heard of it, the incident where Carl Mays, then of the Yankees, hits Ray Chapman in the head in a game, and he kills him. Not intentionally, but there was a lot of intrigue around it. It was the story of the summer of 1920, written by Mike Soule, and I'm just caught up in it. And the reason I bring it up is, in 1920, while the Yankees, then ensconced at the Polo Grounds, are chasing the Cleveland Indians, as they were known then, and the Chicago White Sox in a three-way pennant race for the ages, Babe Ruth, who at that point is Babe Ruth, it's his first year in New York, and he is this huge attraction, and they're going to build a house for him, you might have heard. He leaves the team in the middle of the season because he's got to go shoot a movie. I can't remember the name of the movie offhand. It was just, hey, listen, Babe's, this was not the WBC. This was the Babe Ruth tournaments. This was Babe Ruth saying, I am bigger than the game. I have better things to do than help my team win games. Imagine the podcasters of that age and what they would have done with that. And, you know, came back to the team. And I don't know if the movie did all that well, but he might have been side-eyed a little bit in 1920. So, you know, we tend to think everything that happens is happening for the first time. A lot of it happens again and again and again. Babe Ruth, the Kyrie Irving of his day in many ways.
We'll be back on Thursday with our opening day extravaganza. So subscribe and get ready for our opening day show. That's next Thursday on National League Town. We thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2023, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Check them out on Spotify.